Hello, and welcome to LifeLab. I'm David Ponder.
And I'm Zach Schaefer.
We created a candid podcast for busy people. We get right to the point of our topics, and we keep them to 30 minutes or less.
We wanted to put our ideas out there, share it with people we love, and if it spreads, great.
Our show has no edits and no gimmicks.
Like it or don't, we initially started this project for ourselves, to record our thoughts for our kids, but our friends and family thought we should share it, so here you go.
Hello, welcome to LifeLab. Today we're talking about something that I think is very important. Not to say that any of our topics are not important, but this one is something that when you reach the end of your life, you're going to think about. We're going to talk about regrets today.
Yep. Downer.
You know, it can be a downer topic, or you can look at it as, I don't know, try to look at it as if you think about them ahead of time, then you can avoid them. Hopefully that's, you know, and you can try to look at them from a positive point of view too, right? So like if you focus on them from a positive point of view, it's like, what are the things that I want to do? How do I fill my time with things that I love and enjoy? And if I follow that, then I'll probably minimize my regrets.
Yeah. I mean, that's a pretty proactive way of looking at the topic, I think. For me, I believe that this topic is probably something that most people actively avoid thinking about, especially the younger they are. Hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, I think when you're young, you feel like, you know, your whole future is ahead of you anyway, and you'll just make up for whatever later. You know what I mean?
I've got time. I've got time to do that.
Yeah. And so it's funny how we've mentioned time. We're only a minute into this and we've mentioned time. I said, fill your time with positive things. You know, when you're young, you've got all this time ahead of you. And I think that touches on this because when you think about regrets, you think about, well, I mean the definition, right? So we usually do definitions. Basically, the definition that I get is feeling sadness or disappointment over something that's happened or has been done.
Hmm.
And if you think about how time plays into that, things are always happening and things are always being done. The older that you get, the more that has happened and the more that has been done, and the less that will happen or will be done in front of you. So it becomes more precious to you. Every moment becomes more important, has more weight.
Hopefully.
If you think about it, right? Like I would suppose there are people who just drift through life and don't consider those things. And then at the end it hits them and they're like, oh damn.
Right. I mean, but if you just sit around thinking about it too, that's not much action.
No. I think you just have to live your life with the general awareness of it, right?
Sure.
Well, whenever you're faced with, okay, what's going to happen? What am I going to do? Then this is something that needs to be in the background.
Right. I mean, for me, not all regrets aren't created equal. So I tend to break it down in terms of micro and macro regrets. So we all have micro regrets, probably on a daily basis. And those can then boil down into two other categories. Those are chances we didn't take or things that we didn't do that we maybe wanted to do, whether it's giving that homeless person a dollar when we drove by or giving someone, a stranger, a compliment, or bigger things, you know, telling your wife or your kids you love them before you leave and you didn't do that. Or there are mistakes that we made that we don't take ownership for or that we don't learn from. To me, those are really the only kind of regrets we have, micro and macro. And then you can boil both of those categories down into things we didn't do, the chances we didn't take that we really wanted to because we were scared and driven by fear and what others might think of us. And then the mistakes that we made and errors that we've created for ourselves and others that we don't own and apologize and learn from.
I love everything you said there. I have two things that I wouldn't mind drilling into. Number one, the concept of fear driving us. And number two, the question, are you sure that regrets are only things that we don't own? I feel like you can own something and you can learn from it and you could still regret it.
Give me an example.
Okay, so a real estate purchase, right? So I've made, my wife and I have made a couple real estate purchases that we ended up in bad situations for years, having to work our way out of, and we ended up doing so.
Okay, I see what you're talking about. Actual ownership, financial. I was talking about ownership.
No, not even that. I mean, like, concept. I own that decision. Like, I have on my notes here, trust your gut and go against the herd, because on one of these decisions, I had a bad feeling about it before we went through with it, but I was talked out of that bad feeling by conversations with Lauren, by conversations with clearly the people who have a vested interest in the sale going through, advisors, like real estate agents and things like that, right? And I didn't trust my gut. I didn't go against the herd, and I regretted it. But I own that decision. I learned a huge lesson from it. Is it still a regret? Hell yeah. If I could go back and do it differently, I would do it differently. I regret it.
Hmm. I just can't think of a single big regret like that. And I've had plenty of fucked up stuff I've done in my life, but I truly look at it as more of a Buddhist philosophy. Life is suffering, people. Life is suffering. Life is wanting and desiring and not getting the things we want and desire on a daily basis. So I'm not going to spend my life regretting and wishing. I think if that had gone differently, a whole series of other events in your life could have gone differently.
You're probably right. Because
your life wouldn't have turned out the exact same way had you not made that real estate decision.
You're right. And that probably influences and helps me in areas that I don't recognize.
Right.
And I'm certain that's true. But this is cool. This actually leads me to something that I wanted to talk about, which is I'm analytical, overly analytical, right? And so when we talk about fear driving people's life and decisions, I get in this state of analysis paralysis where I put off a decision, and I've learned, and it's taken years and it's taken bad experiences, I've learned that by putting off a decision, I am making a decision. Time is still going by and I'm missing out on opportunity by doing that, right? But that, man, that took me some time to learn. That took me some heartache to go through. I was always the kid who, do you remember Choose Your Own Adventure books?
Mm-hmm.
I was always the kid who thumbed the Y in the road, because I said, always was like, okay, I'm going to make this decision, but I want to know what would happen if I made the other decision too.
That's who you are
since I was young. Yeah.
Hmm.
So I would always go back. That's the thing I loved about Choose Your Own Adventure books, is I could go back and see what would have happened if I took the other path.
Well, recently I shared a tool that Tim Ferriss created and uses called fear setting. It's very similar to goal setting, except it's about defining and understanding what drives your fears and why they're not as bad as you think they are, oftentimes. And one of the things he has people elaborate on is what he calls the costs of inaction. And to me, that's really what you're getting at here, is it's difficult from a business or a personal standpoint to figure out what are those opportunity costs for not taking this path.
Right.
You know, and I think that's a smart thing to think about and try to come up with some answers to, because most people don't do that.
Yeah, there's that fear setting exercise. If everyone, if you have a chance, go look it up. You can just Google fear setting
Tim Ferriss. It'll pop up.
And it's a really great exercise. If you guys are making decisions, I would encourage going through that exercise. That being said, I think what we're talking about can be related to both what I was talking about on that thumb setting.
Mm-hmm.
So not only is it just a cost of inaction, there's a cost of action too. For every door you walk through, there are at least one other door that you didn't walk through and that you may never be able to walk through again. And to me, the way I would describe that is the fear of missing out. The fear of missing out on walking through that other door, right?
Right.
And what would that have been like? Could it have been better? No doubt. With the amount of decisions that we make, I love your micro and your macro analogy, right? So whenever I go to restaurants, I find myself ordering things that I know that I like. And lately, I've been trying to force myself. No, don't do that, man. Yeah, sure. The pot roast at Big Sky is awesome, but they've got this whole menu that you haven't tried. Eat something else. And even when I'm disappointed, who cares? It was one meal. You know what I mean?
Right.
Applying that to the macro is much harder for me. But, you know, Life Lab and what we talk about is being being open, being curious, and being exploratory. And in the micro, I think it's easier to make those decisions and say, I'm going to be curious, I'm going to be exploratory. In the macro, man, that fear of missing out on the other option or
sure
whatever.
For you personally, for me, that drives it can you. Become to me, paralyzing. There's another whole level, right? And one of the strengths of, I believe, our podcast is our ability to weave in our kids. Because anything I do in life, I want to be a lesson for my kids. And they don't always have to be positive lessons. It's like, oh, dad did this, I'm going to make sure not to do that. Your whole real estate transaction should be an awesome lesson for your kids eventually.
And it will
you
be.
Know?
I'll do the best that I can to, as parents, we don't want our kids to repeat mistakes that we've made, right? We want to pass along as much wisdom as we can to them. Sometimes there are just certain things that kids are going to have to learn on their own. They're just going to have to go through and make the mistakes. They'll hear the stories and they'll say, well, yeah, but I want to do it anyway, or I want to find out anyway. Hopefully with big things like real estate transactions, that's not the case.
So everything you've talked about really is summarized in a phrase I've repeated on this show and I try to live my life by, and that's Hunter Thompson's, buy the ticket, take the ride.
Right.
And Dave, what you're talking about is with, in terms of regret and being driven by analysis or fear sometimes, is you buy the ticket and then you sit back and you analyze and watch the rides for a while before you get on.
Yeah. Well, it's a couple things. It's buying the ticket, getting on the ride, being on the ride, right? But maybe not being able to fully experience it because you're looking at the other ride across the way or wondering, you know, using your imagination, your imagination muscle. There was a really great podcast that I heard, and it may have been like a TED Radio Hour podcast. It was about happiness, and it talked about how humans are amazing because we have this imagination ability. We have a simulation tool that other things don't, other animals don't have, and we can project. Like, we don't have to go eat some sardine flavored ice cream. We know that's going to be terrible. We don't have to mix it up and put it in our mouth to figure it out. We can imagine what that's like, right? And so we can do the same thing with future decisions. The problem comes when we use it retroactively for, like, I can imagine what it would have been like had I made this other decision, if I make a decision that I'm not enjoying the ride that I'm on right now. And then I'm using my imagination muscle to create this, you know, wonderful world where I made the other decision. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I also don't want to make it seem like I'm someone who goes through life with zero regrets. I would say I'm a master of having micro regrets, probably more than the average person. For those people that know me, I'm pretty sharp in my tone, not necessarily in my intellect. And, you know, when you live on the edge, you're going to bleed and you're going to cut other people. So my tone, especially with those closest to me, when I'm not being conscious and I'm just being Zach, it can come off like a real bastard, especially with Kizzy. And I'm thinking specifically, recently I made a small comment to her about something she was wearing. And it wasn't trying to be assholish, but it totally was. And I didn't apologize in the moment, even though I saw in her face that I should have. I did apologize later that night and brought it back up. And she being the awesome person, of course, forgave me and we moved on. But it makes me think of something Larry David said in Curb Your Enthusiasm. And he said, I'm a master of apologizing, because his character has to do it so often. And I feel very similar. And when I apologize, I mean it. I don't say sorry unless I truly mean it. But I'm constantly saying, and more or less the manner in which I say things, I'm analyzing and thinking through, being a communication expert, too much to a degree, and then apologizing for those things. So I have a million micro things that I'm like, oh, damn it, I shouldn't have said it, or I shouldn't have said it that way. But in terms of macro, I really can't think of a single everything I've done to my life up to this point, and people could label as good or bad, right or wrong, morally or ethically, just or unjust. It's made me who I am and everybody around me who they are, and I have zero regrets.
That's true, and I think that's probably one of the keys to being content with the life that you have. You know, whenever you look at other people and you see other people that have it, quote-unquote, better off than you, and in one way or another, it's easy to imagine a decision that you would have made in the past. Oh, if I would have just, what's the Money for Nothing by Dire Straits?
Right.
If I'd have just learned to play the guitar, right, I'd have
Money for Nothing and Chicks for Free.
Yeah, exactly. So, the what we're talking about is interesting. We're talking about two things. Number one, you're talking about, well, micro versus macro, and that's important. But you're also talking about regretting things that you've done, right? Versus what I think I'm talking about is regretting things that I haven't done.
Right. Well, yeah, and that goes back to my chances we didn't take versus mistakes we've made. So again, I focused more on the mistakes I made because I take the chances usually.
And the way that I've looked at things, like the way that I'm admitting that the way that I look at things is a loser's game because you can't win, right? Because no matter how good the decision you make has been, you can always imagine
a better outcome,
a different decision that was better.
Do you remember what Robert Anton Wilson calls that?
No, what is it?
Loser scripts.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. That's what it is. And I admit that I'm prone to it, right?
Here's something that I got to listen to John Mozeliak speak a few years back. This kind of ties into what we're talking about, but somebody asked him a question about just, you know, coming from this rich history of the Cardinals and how he either uses that or doesn't use that to his advantage on a daily basis as their general manager. And I'm paraphrasing, and I added to this, but he basically said, look, when you're in a rich traditional organization or family, you have to respect and learn from the past. You have to live for the present at the same time focusing on the future. Right? And it's easier to say, harder to do.
Right.
But to me, you can pull in regrets. Like, think of his job. Oh, man, I didn't draft this dude, and look at what he's doing this season. Mm. He'd be fired. If he lived his job through that lens, he would be fired as the GM because you can't. No doubt. Or think of what you do for a living as a coder, a problem solver. There's a million ways to do things more or less efficiently. So once you make a decision and go down that track, what if you lived through the, oh, could have done it this way lens? What would happen?
Yeah, it would be, I would be ineffective, you know, as a
I think you'd be unemployed.
Potentially. Potentially. And that's no doubt. But what I'm saying is it's a psychology that you can get into when you look at your life as a whole, and I'm prone to it. So with that being said, clearly I'm prone to it. You seem to not be. So if there's anyone out there struggling with that same thing, what would you say to them? Can you think of any techniques, or is it just like – just inherent in, like, yeah, it's just part of your nature?
For me, I think it's just part of my nature. I don't look at how I do my lists and my calendar, right? It's from a very small tactical. There, once the list is done, it's thrown away. I delete every single thing on my calendar. So every day beyond today, looking to the past, is blank because I don't need to look back at it. I've got a million things to do today and tomorrow. And so that's at a very small level. I don't look back and go, oh, crap, this is the day I didn't talk to Anheuser-Busch or whoever.
You know where I got this? I got it. I can tell you where. I got it from my mom. Hmm.
Mary.
Yeah, thanks, Mom. My mom's the most loving and caring and wonderful person in the world.
Yep.
But she has, it's almost like buyer's remorse or something is what would be the way to describe it. There have been instances where my mom and dad have made a big purchase, and it was like, they went and they made the big purchase, but there was like a 72-hour window where they could get out of it. And my mom then freaked out and got out of it because she did what I'm talking about, right? So she – and I find myself that I don't know if it's genetic or, you know, environmental, but I got it. Whatever that is, I got that. So whenever I'm making some large decisions, to me, to you, there's a decision point. Boom, there's a Y in the road. And you go one way, and that's it. You never look back.
And I'm not saying that's great. That's just how I do it.
Right. For me, I see the why coming up, and then I'm in the decision zone.
Mm-hmm. The buffer.
And it's like, I'm going to go right. But in my head, it's like, you could still go left. Like, you could still go left. Until this point, you could still go left. And I'm in that 72-hour window.
We're getting into decision-making strategies and theory and philosophy. And I have actually shared with my students some photos of how Dave, I'm sure Dave drove this, and his wife Lauren make major decisions. For anyone who knows the idea of the rational actor model, it's basically a cost-benefit analysis, right? T-chart, pros and cons. Most people do it in their heads, might write something down on a piece of paper. Dave literally went out and bought whiteboards and organized him and Lauren to do multiple nights during the week to write out all the contingency plans. And I believe this was related to your real estate scenario, which makes sense. Yeah. But I took those photos and showed students and I said, look, this is what a really analytical person looks like when they're trying to make a decision. And it blew their mind. They had never seen somebody do that in their 30s, like really trying to make a good life decision. And they liked seeing that.
Well, it's good and it's bad, though, right? Because there's no guarantee that that's the right decision. And the amount of angst that you go through. And then if it's wrong anyway, you know what I mean? You just put yourself through hell and you have to deal with regret. But yeah, so I guess when I was saying, you know, are there any techniques that you would recommend? I like the idea, and I've been trying to embrace more recently the idea of understanding that when you make large life decisions that there is a risk and that you just have to be comfortable with that. I'm getting better at trying to take a step back and look at myself as if I were a third party and say, yeah, I'm experiencing some angst about that decision that I made, and yeah, I'm still in that decision zone where I could switch it, but I committed to it when I decided that that was the right way to go in the beginning. And all I'm doing is causing myself pain from here until the point where there is no return. And you can't see the future. So just go ahead and commit and really enjoy it. Like you said, buy the ticket, take the ride, enjoy the ride. Like if you don't, because here's the thing, the decision that you made is either the best decision or the not the best decision that you could have made. But after that point, it doesn't matter whether it's the best or it's not.
It's just
the best.
A decision. It's done.
And if you don't live and embrace that decision, you're making your current present day worse.
Right. I guess another, you asked tactics for the macro regrets for people not to wallow on them too long. Is it does go back to your goals, your big level goals. I know what mine are. They're very clear to me. So all these decisions I'm making, somewhere in my head is rolling around. Where is 55-year-old Zach? Where is 65-year-old Zach? Where is 85-year-old Zach? And those imaginative scenarios where I see myself and that person that I want to be at that point in my life, I'll ask, does this decision take one step towards those Zachs or one step back? Or do I stay sitting there?
That's a good thing to do. When you're using that idea muscle, you can use it in a proactive way, right?
Right.
And that's the way to do it. Don't do it retroactively. Well, using it retroactively just causes you heartbreak and pain.
Well, and the other thing ties into literally the slogan of this show, experiment with life. So if we stop framing these decisions as the end-all be-all of our life on this planet Earth surrounded by other humans and just frame it as, yeah, it's a decision and I'm resilient. I'm going to bounce back if it ends up being not the best decision I could have made and experiment with life.
That's the positive mindset. I will be resilient and I will bounce back.
I will overcome.
Yeah. So envision, like use your idea muscle and think, oh, I made this decision and here's the negative thing. And guess what? Doesn't matter. I'm going to be resilient and bounce back and use it to, you know, learn from it. If you think about, you know, we're talking about regrets here. And is that an apt way of, or a accurate way of describing it, right? Using that idea or using that imagination simulator retroactively, right? When people regret things, that's what they're doing, is it not? They're looking at the past and saying, wish I woulda or wish I wouldn't have.
Don't wish your life away. I forget who told me that years ago. Don't wish or don't what if your life away. You ain't got enough life to do it.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, it totally makes sense. There, you know, when you think about regretting things, right? They're kind of predicated going back to the time thing, on the fact that time's like a it's always going in one direction. It's always flowing.
It's
right?
The one resource that humans share.
So when you look back at the path that you have traveled and the things that you've moved past, knowing that you can't go backwards, and then using your idea machine to say, man, you know, I always wanted to learn to play the piano and I never did. I regret not doing that. Mm-hmm. Or I wish I wouldn't have spent so much time at work. We always bring up the AARP article, the mm-hmm. 5 Regrets of the Dying,
yep.
which
was really tied into today's topic.
Yeah, surprising that it hasn't come up until now. But they're looking backwards at life and saying, I wish I wouldn't have worked so much. I wish I would have spent more time.
Here's
with
something I've thought of recently regarding that article. I don't know this, but do wealthy people, high net worth individuals, people earning $2 million, not even $1 million, $2 million or more a year for many years, do they end up in hospice or do they have their own private thing come to their house? Why I ask this is I'm wondering if there's a socioeconomic variable that explains many middle class, maybe even to upper middle class and lower class, if you will, people use hospice. Do high net worth people use it? If so, would they say something different? Would they even say not work so hard? Maybe they value that.
That's actually a really great
point. And I thought about this a lot. I just keep forgetting to bring it up.
You know, that's a really great point. I would imagine that they use it less, you know, and it would be great to get the perspective of a home hospice nurse who works, you know, with wealthy people.
Like a concierge service.
You know how you interviewed, you know, multimillionaires mm-hmm. and even some billionaires mm-hmm. for a while to get their perspectives on life.
Sure.
I wonder if that wouldn't be an amazing exercise to try and reach out to a travel nurse or a home hospice nurse who works with wealthy people and get their same viewpoint. Have them read that AARP article and get their spin on it.
Clearly, I'm not saying that what we read isn't valuable. I've shared that article more than any other thing I've read in my life. I'm just curious if extremely wealthy individuals would have the same themes or patterns that emerge. But maybe, you know, that's then predicated on the fact that these nurses dealing with them would be asking these questions. And maybe they're viewed as a servant to those type people, so they would feel uncomfortable even bringing it up. I don't know.
Well, they weren't dying, but it seemed that, if I recall correctly, one of the themes that came out of your interviews with these wealthy people was one of the themes that you see in that AARP article, which is, I wish I would have spent more time with the people that I love rather than working or rather than, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Today, gosh, on our phone, rather than looking at my damn phone.
I just saw something really interesting, not related, but we do tangentials. Having your phone out on your desk decreases working memory by 10%. Having it in your pocket decreases it by a little less than that 5%. And again, working memory being like, I'm focusing on this current task, computer analogy.
Right.
And I didn't get into the methodological stance of how they did it. I should do that. But it was really interesting, and I feel it. If I have my phone out on a desk, I am not in the moment in that conversation. So whenever I'm dealing with students or clients specifically, I make sure my phone's in my bag so I'm in the moment.
I love that. That's actually... You know, we've been doing no screen,
yep.
Dinner, all the way basically until bedtime with the kids. And it's forced us to do things like play the memory game, play dance, you know, like we play our Sonos and we dance in the kitchen and the dining room. And it's been amazing how that time feels richer and fuller, you know. When I was looking up notes for this topic, regrets, one of the more recent articles talked about phones and technology as sort of like siphons, like time siphons.
Oh, yeah.
That are sucking away. Like, if we're talking about not having regrets as filling your time to the fullest and the most meaningful and being able to live in the present, it's amazing how phones and computer screens and things can be these time siphons. Like, these binge watching.
They're
TV
technological
things.
Black holes. And I'm ultra guilty of the TV binge watching stuff. I binge and purge with everything I do in my life. One last question, because we're getting to the end. What's the relationship for you, Dave, between regrets and excuses?
Excuses to me are either made to try to make myself feel better about something that I regret or to try to convince someone else to still allow me to achieve the goal that I was hoping to achieve with them, despite the thing that I had done that they didn't
despite
like.
Despite the fact that you might not have held a commitment to something you said you were gonna.
Yeah, there's an idea that we haven't discussed, which is whether you consider yourself successful in life or not, I believe is predicated on this notion that you're able to manipulate your environment to your desires. You're able to manipulate your environment to your desires. So you're able to convince people that what you want should happen, right? It's something that politicians try to do. It's something that authority figures are able to do through power structures. The ability to manipulate your environment and have your desired outcome happen is that, right? So an excuse, I think, is a tool to say, oh man, bad mistake. I can see the outcome I wanted isn't coming. If I could come up with a good enough excuse, maybe I could paper over that,
right,
and still achieve what I was trying to.
Sam Silverstein wrote a book. He's a professional speaker, actually out of St. Louis. Great guy. Served as a business mentor for me for a while. He has a book called No Excuses, and he's an accountability expert. And he says, before we share excuses with others, we convince ourselves of the soundness of the story.
Yeah.
And I could hear it right when you were just explaining hypothetically how we go through it. Okay, why did this? Okay, yeah, this is why this happened. So we sell ourselves on the bullshit first before we try to sell it to other people.
I've learned as I've gotten older, though, that people see through that, and you're probably better off owning up to it. And so think about that for yourself, right? If that's one of your regrets when you're thinking about things when you die, maybe it's better to just own up to it rather than saying, yeah, but I did it for this other person and that's why, or yeah, but if I would have done that, this would have been much harder. You're just trying to make yourself feel better. And you at your core see through that. And there's probably some unresolved negative feelings that continue because of
right.
it. What if you just own it and say, yeah, that's right, I do
take responsibility.
That.
Responsibility, yeah. Accountability, commitment are the sort of antithesis to regrets.
So I know we're getting down to the end. I'd like to read the five regrets off of this article.
Go ahead.
Because I think they're very important. We're not going to give them justified time, but I think they're important. Number one, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself, not the life others expected of me. Number two, I wish I didn't work so hard.
Number three, I wish I had chosen to be happy.
Number three, yeah, I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. That's
well, I know I have the five memorized. I don't know what order they're
okay,
in.
Okay, got it. Yeah, that's number five. I wish that I'd let myself be happier. And then, so the last one, I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends.
Yep.
I wish I'd stayed in touch with my friends.
I see that right now because that's important to me, is keeping and maintaining friendship. Actually, I sent out a recent email to a lot of people saying, what's my expertise? And one of the biggest themes that's coming back is my ability to create and maintain relationships. And why is because that is fulfilling to me personally. It's an ego thing in a positive way. It makes me feel good about me, the fact that I can cultivate and maintain these relationships that give my life meaning and I hope give others' lives meaning.
Oh, you're a connector.
But my point is, I actively do that, and I now am very actively seeing which people that might have once been on an inner circle aren't as much anymore. No fault. I reach out to them as often as I do anyone else, and that's just not what they want.
Your skill set and keep being a hub in the wheel and spoke system is advanced.
But
I'll
it gives me
that.
Energy. I have a need to connect and interact. Well, but other people don't, and that's fine.
Well, no, and it's so funny. I think it's why we're so complimentary. I need a hub, and you're so very good at being that. And so I think we complement each other in that way.
Sure.
I'll say a couple important things that we didn't get to say. On the one that says, I wish I'd let myself be happier, the important thing to take out of that is happiness is a choice. And people realize that at the end, right? And it's too late if you wait till the end to realize that. And then the last thing, and you can get really deep on both of these, is on the I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. It's like I wish I'd had and lived the life that I wanted rather than what others expected of me. It's letting that fear setting dictate your life. And I wanted to talk about this on a super macro level, how people end up getting jobs, buying houses, going to college, having kids, because that's what other people expect them to do.
They think that that's what's expected of them.
They go to a job that they hate, and they let a boss tell them that they have to sit in a chair in a cubicle from this hour to this hour, and they don't fight against it because they think, well, that's what you do. That's what you're supposed to do. They don't realize that you can get out there and fight that. You can fight that authority because you don't have to be the pushover. You know, find a way to make everything happen and do it on your terms. Like, that's what life is about.
Here's a perfect example of that. I was with someone, I was previously engaged prior to getting married to Kizzy. And we had a great relationship for many years, but it was a long-term relationship. And towards the end, it wasn't a good relationship for us or the people surrounding us. It was an unhealthy relationship. And, you know, we decided that I was moving down to Texas A&M to start my PhD program. She had started her career and was kicking ass. And it was just like, what are we doing? Why are we still together? Because we're high school sweethearts. So, the next step's get married. That's what people expect of us. And we're both clearly much happier and have great relationships and kids and are doing excellent in our careers. Had we made that choice of society, let's stay together, that's what we do,
right,
we would have made each other more miserable, I'm sure, and made others around us more miserable for who knows how long.
That's right. And things turned out pretty well
for both of us.
For both of you. You guys both found people that are your match, no doubt. So
here's some change challenges.
Let's do some change challenges.
I want you to get frozen, people. Get frozen. Let it go. Let it go.
Yeah. I thought you were saying the opposite. Like, get frozen in analysis.
No. I want you to let something go. That's a choice, too. We hold on to these regrets, whether they're micro or macro. Figure out a way to just let one of your regrets go. And there's no universal formula to walk through that. That's up to you.
I'll challenge you to inspect your life and find one thing that is a part of your life, not by your choice, by default, by society's choosing.
Oh, I like that.
And eradicate it. Be a rebel in that way. See how that makes you feel. For me, whenever I do those things, I find that I feel like a weight has been lifted from my chest. Like I'm a little bit more free. And that my life's a little bit better. And I think that is an awesome change challenge.
I got one more small one that's on the micro level. Apologize to someone. It doesn't matter if you did it 2 years ago, a month ago, 5 minutes ago. Just apologize and be authentic from the heart. Apologies are therapeutic for you and the other person, even if it doesn't right the wrong that happened. It's what Dave Zendejas calls relational lube. It's just a necessary part of dealing with humans. We got to own up to things, apologize, and it's okay to forgive and not forget.
There's a lot of gold in this episode.
I love gold.
If you rewind this and hear every sentence that we said, there are just tips galore on things to do and things to implement. I like the change challenges that we gave. Go ahead, pick one of those, do that change challenge, and you know, reflect.
Shoot us an email. We love hearing from people.
We'd love to hear how the things worked out for you, and maybe we'll interview you on a future episode to talk about it.
Sounds good. Enjoy the day, and remember, experiment with life.
Fill your time with things you love. Experiment with life, people.